You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2011, novelist Colson Whitehead was asked if he was interested in writing about sports, which led to an assignment to cover the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, a seven-day casino tournament. But Mr. Whitehead didn't just want to write about it, he wanted to play in it. He'd been a casual player since his college days, but he had never participated in a tournament. His latest book, The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death, is the story of that experience. It's published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased that it brings Colson Whitehead back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, howdy.
You started on this shortly after you'd finished your novel, Zone One, and you came on this show to promote that book, but I don't remember you mentioning this new venture. Were you already preparing for it?
When Zone One came out, I had just finished my tour at the World Series of Poker. I was trying to take a break. You know, I found writing about zombies, the living dead, quite exhausting. You know, the plunge into autobiography was very taxing and wanted a break. And then this assignment came from Grantland. And if you know, like cards as I do, it was the assignment of a lifetime. So I had no choice but to take it.
But you also start out this book with this sentence: I have a good poker face because I am half dead inside.
Well, you know, I mean,
does that mean that there'll be no more zombie novels for you, no matter how benign some of the zombies may be?
Well, I mean, that book came out of zombie anxiety dreams I had ever since I was a kid. You know, I saw horror movies from a very early age, and they imprinted themselves upon me. So actually writing that book got rid of my zombie dreams. I know people who read the book now have zombie anxiety dreams, but for me, that got rid of it. Part of the fun of the assignment was trying a different sort of persona and being able to tell more jokes than I could in Zone One.
Well, why do you think you've had a naturally good affect for playing poker?
I think it's genetics. It's formative experiences. People have always said, you know, you probably have a great poker face. It's good at the poker table. You know, people think I have a great hand or I'm bluffing. Really, I'm just thinking about regrets and, you know, mistakes I made 10 years ago. But they project things upon me. And it's very good for poker. It's not good in human relationships, but, you know, I make some money off of it.
Well, you're also wearing sunglasses. Don't most of the serious poker players wear sunglasses?
If you watch it on TV, yeah, a good percentage are wearing sunglasses. You can't see their eyes. What are they thinking? And when I was doing my training missions, I thought, oh, that's kind of jerky and kind of pretentious. But the first time I walked into the Rio Casino in Las Vegas, where they do the World Series of Poker, I was wearing sunglasses because I'd been outside. And I thought, I feel much more comfortable. And it became part of my armor, hiding my eyes.
Can you get them in Sunglass Hut?
Sunglasses? any pair where they're either mirrored or incredibly dark, and it helps your imposing face.
But do you think poker faces is common among New Yorkers? On the subway, you see a wide variety of utilitarian poker faces.
Well, no, I think, you know, the subway is good training.
Don't mess with me.
Keep walking. You know, I was on the subway today, and someone was eating a very sort of fragrant meal with a spoon. And I think my rule is, if you require a spoon or fork to eat it, don't eat it on the subway. And I was trying to glare at her, but she just kept eating. So in general, a poker face is good for all number of things in the city.
Has your restraint, your lack of affect, caused you any difficulties in your personal life?
Well, in all sorts of areas. You know, I try to force smiles with my kids so I can teach them the importance of human contact and relating. So it takes a bit of an effort, fake smile, sort of, take their toll on you. But it's important, I think, to teach the children, to give back to other people.
They take a toll on you because then you have all those muscles that you have to exercise that you wouldn't normally exercise?
They say it takes more muscles to smile than frown, and I definitely feel that. You know, it's very wearying.
Can you describe the place you describe as your country of citizenship, the Republic of Anhedonia?
Well, you know, it's the World Series of Poker, nations from all over the globe participating. So I was trying to think of who do I represent? And, of course, I'm, American a lot of the time. But I think my true homeland is the Republic of Anhedonia. Anhedonia from psychiatry, meaning the inability to feel pleasure. And ever since I...
Or happiness.
Or anything, yeah. And ever since I first heard that word, I sort of felt a real kinship for it. So it seemed like the Republic of Anhedonia included me and probably a lot of New Yorkers, people who sort of trudge through their day trying to figure out how to get through life. So I'd be playing for them. I'd be playing for the other people in my country land.
But aren't most gamblers looking for the big thrill, the big payoff, proof that that God loves them?
Well, I think, you know, gamblers are romantic. You know, the hope that the next card will fill in that that straight, that the third seven will give them trips. You're always hoping for a good spin of the wheel, the dealer to give you some good cards. And so there's a lot of hope in gambling. Obviously, if you're an addict, that's a different sort of thing that's going on. But there's a lot of hope involved in gambling, that the fates will smile upon you and complete your hand.
I'm just curious, why do you say that Anhedonians invented brunch?
Because brunch is terrible. So obviously, if it's terrible, it's probably from Anhedonia.
You think brunch is terrible?
You know, you're getting up on the weekend, all sorts of things are going wrong. Other people, for one thing, other people are pressing around you.
Is that why people drink at brunch often?
Hopefully,
that,
you know,
Bloody Mary?
Two or three drinks will ease the pain.
My guest is Colson Whitehead. His latest book is not a novel, although you've written other nonfiction books. This one's called The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. How much poker had you played before you got this assignment?
I was a home player for like 20 years, $5 buy-in game. And then I quickly learned that that's sort of not really what you play in the World Series of Poker. Tournament poker has different betting conventions, different rhythms. So I had to start training, and that meant getting books, you know, the proper books. It meant getting a poker coach and going to Atlantic City to play in real casinos and figure out how to play tournaments.
But unlike those other people, you had someone else providing your stake. Does that change things?
Well, I mean, the magazine Grantland gave me $10,000 to play. That's the entrance fee. And most players are scraping up for years to go to the World Series of Poker. They love the game, and it's their big trip. And that was my fee for the article. I wasn't getting paid. I think if I was getting paid by Grantland, it probably would have been like 10 pages because I'm very lazy. But because I was writing for free, it ended up being 70 pages, and there was so much stuff I couldn't get into the original article that it became a small book.
At this time in your life, you're also dealing with being newly divorced, a single parent half the week. Was this something of an escape from your new responsibilities?
Well, it allowed me to go to Atlantic City, you know, and gamble all day. You know, I had joint custody of my daughter, and one of the good things about joint custody is that you have some nights free, and also that if you keel over in your apartment, you're only going to go like 36 hours before people look for your decomposing body. So I would drop off my kid at school and, you know, talk to their parents.
And how did they take your schedule?
Well, they'd be like, you know, school year's almost over. And I'd be, yeah, they grew up so fast. You're going off to work? I was like, no, I'm going to Atlantic City to gamble. You know, I see. So it was schizophrenic. I would drop her off at school and then hop on the bus to Atlantic City, the underbelly of Port Authority, and then just run around Atlantic City playing tournaments, gamble, then come back at midnight.
Of course, you knew that when you said, I'm going to Atlantic City to gamble, that you were having – that was – and for effect. I'm going to my work.
It was work. You know, people kept saying, oh, you can write off your tournament fees on your taxes. But it seemed like that'd be a real flag for the IRS. You know, $65 gambling tournament. Not what they want to see, I don't think.
You just said something negative about the Port Authority. What's your problem with it? Other than the Disneyfication.
At 3 a.m., it's quite a different place. You know, of course, it's, you know, like most of Times Square. It's been cleaned up, and you can get a arugula salad to take with you on your trip to New Jersey. But coming back at 3 a.m. in the summer, you get a glimpse of what the Port Authority used to be like, you know, in the good old 70s and 80s, unfortunately.
What are leisure industrial complexes?
Well, I mean, Vegas is the center of the leisure industrial complex, as I call it. When I went on my first trip to Vegas in 91, I thought being a New Yorker, oh, kitschy Vegas, campy Vegas, you know, I'll have a fun time making fun of all the rubes. But of course, I put a nickel into a slot machine, won a couple of dollars, and was converted. And since then, as the powers that be in Vegas have figured out how to make it a much more cohesive resort, all-inclusive, trying to get people who don't like gambling, you know, you can go to a spa, have a nice restaurant. The leisure industrial complex is figuring out how to make Vegas better and bigger.
You played Hold'em. Is that a game you might have played with your friends, your writer friends?
It's, you know, people call it the Cadillac of poker, and it insinuated itself into my game in the 90s.
How does it work?
Perhaps you've seen five-card draw in movies. You get five cards, bet, trade in, bet. So, you know, two rounds of betting, very simple. In seven-card, in Hold'em, you get two down cards that no one sees, and everything proceeds from there. It's a pair of aces or a nine and a two, you know, a bad start. You're staying in, you're folding. You get the flop, which is three up cards that are communal. You bet, another card up. So at the end, you have five communal cards that everyone can see, and your two cards that are down, only you can see, and you're trying to build your best five-card hand out of those.
You had a coach, and she it was a woman, which is that what we might expect?
You know, Helen Ellis, my poker coach, is unexpected in a lot of ways. She's really brilliant. She's a writer and started playing professionally in the last couple years. So we came from different worlds. You know, she's sort of a very proper Southern lady. I'm, you know, a weirdo from New York, and we got into a kind of blindside situation where
blindside the movie with Sandra Bullock and
there are all these racial harmony movies where, say, upstanding Southern white lady helps a weirdo black guy in how to use a fork, and so she didn't teach me how to use the fork, but I was forking up poker knowledge. And it was quite a beautiful thing.
So here you are. You're learning how to play on a tournament level. Meanwhile, you're still playing with your writer friends. What happened when you applied some of the things you were learning to those games?
Well, you know, formerly I was a very kind teacher. You know, if there's someone new in a game, I would say, you know, a pair of twos is, you know, for example, two sevens. And I always explained the dynamics of the game. Once I went to the World Series, you know, and I came back to a more social game, if someone asked a question or played too, you know, slowly, started talking about their allergies or, you know, their kids play, I just want to jump across the table and choke them because I'd played with, you know, the real dudes. And, you know, that sort of penny-ante stuff doesn't cut it there.
You also were you had different kind of discipline when you were working in the tournament, even the matter of just sitting still for a while.
Well, I mean, what I liked about it is that I could apply a lot of the skills from my writing life to poker tournaments. I started writing because, like, you'd sit on your butt all day, and in tournaments, you sit on your butt all day.
So did you take notes?
I took notes at the poker table.
Didn't the other players object?
No, people are always, you know, recording their bad beats. One of the things I learned in talking to, you know, to the sort of higher level players is that they remember bad hands from 10 years ago, and they're replaying them. You know, when they got beat in Atlantic City and Caesars, you know, should I have, you know, doubled him or should I have folded? And so they have, you know, the area of their brain that I use for regrets or mistakes, they use to remember all these incredible hands from years past. So they're taking notes also in the same way that I was taking notes from my article.
You say that your journey was a parallel to the contestants on The Biggest Loser.
Well, you know, I was trying to, you know, shed some baggage and, you know, become a better poker player, a better person. And, of course, on reality TV shows, I watch a lot of reality TV shows, a lot of cooking shows. Basically, if you have, like, two busboys dueling with, like, celery sticks, I would watch it. So it seemed when you're on a reality show, you're trying to better yourself, win some money, and they're on a sort of parallel journey to what I was undergoing with poker.
Now, you had gone to Las Vegas when you were a college student to help a friend do research for the Let's Go books. That was a different, very, very different Atlantic City, wasn't it?
No, yeah. I mean, you still had, you know, the sort of corny casinos. And, of course, now, you know, say, Excalibur, which still stands, you don't, and has a medieval theme. Now they're just a sort of big black monoliths on the strip, and you don't need a theme. Once you get them there, once you get people in there, they're trapped. And so why have these sort of kitschy, gaudy trappings when you just want to park them at a roulette table or park them in front of a spa, a fine meal? You don't need all that kind of theater anymore.
Why do you call poker the noble hustle?
Well, I think we're all engaged in some sort of hustle as we try to get through our day. No matter what kind of job you do or what kind of art you're engaged in, you're hoping in that kind of romantic way that gamblers do for a good hand. How can I reverse my fortunes? How can I get through this book? How can I finish this painting, finish this project? And over the course of following all these different types of gamblers, pros, amateurs, I came to admire just, you know, their love for the game and the way that they sort of struggle through you know, weeks and months and years of bad beats and dead cards.
Well, your subtitle is Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. Would a beef jerky and death come into this story?
Well, of course, everyone loves a stick of beef jerky. It's number one meat snack in America. When I first went to Vegas in 91, I went to a place called the House of Jerky. And it was one man's dream just to have a store that only sold beef jerky, Australian salmon jerky, ostrich jerky. And it seemed to be, and as Jack Link's Beef Jerky became the main sponsor of the sort of corporate commercial World Series of Poker, beef jerky became a way to talk about how corporate interest has sort of taken over the game. So beef jerky, as always, a fruitful metaphor.
And since you've written about death before, I'm not going to ask you about that.
It's always there.
It's always there.
It's always waiting.
Are you tempted to play in another tournament?
It's very, you know, $10,000 is very expensive. I'm very cheap. Going to the World Series has made me impatient for very slow social games, but also I lose $100 and I get depressed. So I'm not going to start going to Mohegan Sun or whatever and start playing in tournaments. If I'm around in a... say a mile away, I might make a detour and play a tournament because I love the game. But
has it affected the pleasure you received from playing in your writers' group?
Well, you know, the writers' game is a social game, and you know, I'm there to see my friends. You know,
so we're still playing with them?
Yeah, I mean, we're not really sort of cafe writers. We are in our houses, you know, writing our books, and the only time we really see each other is if we get together to play. So it's a lovely social time. You know, the catch up and see what we're doing. We don't talk about work, really. We just play cards.
And I get the feeling that all the skills that you acquired in preparing for the tournament are relevant when you're playing on that level.
Yes, but, you know, I still, you know...
They're not counting cards. They're not doing all the things that you assume the other players are doing when you're playing high stakes.
But when we deal, I do sort of feel that sort of rush I felt when I, you know, on... when I got to the World Series of Poker and started putting all my knowledge together and playing properly. And I remember what a great time I had those couple of days before I washed out.
Colson Whitehead is the New York Times bestselling author of Zone 1, Sag Harbor, The Intuitionist, John Henry Days, Apex Hides the Hurt, and a collection of essays called The Colossus of New York. His latest is The Noble Hustle, Power, Beef Jerky, and Death. It is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me back.